Hello and welcome to Roots of Today, the podcast where the past meets the present. With every episode, we journey through time, uncovering the lessons, parallels, and connections between historical milestones and current events to create a deeper understanding of the compelling stories and issues that shape the news. As the ICE raids and massive deportations continue, labor shortages are inevitable, especially in the agricultural and construction industries. Estimates of the number of ICE deportations vary from the official number of over 200,000 to about half that from independent sources. The number of self-deportations varies widely, from an official count of just over 100,000 to as much as 1 million being reported by some media outlets. This is in roughly 6 months. If this trend continues, a labor shortage will be impossible to avoid. And that brings us to this week's topic. If there is one constant in the world, it is that government actions cause problems, and then the same government acts to solve those problems with government programs. In this case, someone will propose a guest worker program to flood the labor force with workers from south of the border. Fortunately, there is an example we can learn from, because the United States had a guest worker program for 20 years. So if we are going to have a debate about bringing in temporary workers, then it is prudent to examine how it worked the last time. As always, this is Alan, your host, reminding you to grab your coffee, tea, or whatever beverage you prefer as we dive in. To begin, let us state the obvious. Every political decision answers to the law of unintended consequences. In the case of the policy of mass deportations, there are economic outcomes that cannot be avoided. The United States has long relied on immigrant labor to support key sectors such as agriculture, construction, and services. The current pace of deportations has significant economic consequences, particularly in border states such as California and Texas, which are home to large populations of undocumented workers. Labor-intensive industries such as agriculture will be among the first and most severely affected. California's Central Valley and Ventura County, major hubs for U.S. food production, reported severe labor shortages as workers fled or avoided areas with heightened ICE presence. This will lead to crops rotting in fields due to a lack of available labor. Similarly, Texas construction firms experienced significant project delays, with some halting operations altogether. The ripple effects extended beyond individual sectors, weakening local tax bases and consumer demand as immigrant families either left or significantly reduced spending. At a macroeconomic level, mass deportation policies are projected to shrink the U.S. real GDP by 4 to 7%, a contraction comparable to the Great Recession. The Joint Economic Committee estimated that eliminating the entire undocumented workforce would cost the U.S. $1.6 trillion over a decade. In California alone, the annual GDP could decline by over $100 billion, with Texas facing losses exceeding $60 billion. Moreover, the tax contributions of undocumented workers, more than $25 billion annually to Social Security and $5 billion to Medicare, would disappear, creating further budgetary pressure. The economic multiplier effect worsens the situation. Deportation not only reduces the workforce but also disrupts adjacent sectors. For example, fewer available childcare and elder care workers may force some U.S.-born women to exit the workforce, thereby shrinking labor force participation. Moreover, contrary to expectations that deportations would benefit U.S.-born workers, studies from the Brookings Institution found they often resulted in lower overall employment and wages due to decreased economic activity. Economists across the political spectrum have voiced their views on these outcomes. Critics of the deportation policy, such as analysts from the Brookings and the American Immigration Council, warn that such actions will devastate the economy. Brookings researchers noted that mass deportation would lead to a loss of 4.2% to 6.8% of annual U.S. GDP. Likewise, the Peterson Institute predicted a 7.4% GDP decline and a 6.7% drop in employment over a 10-year horizon. Some economists defend the potential long-term benefits of deportation enforcement. Stephen Camerota of the Center for Immigration Studies argues that immigration depresses wages and job opportunities for certain segments of native-born workers. Paul Krugman, though generally supportive of immigration, acknowledged in earlier writings that low-skilled immigration could reduce wages for domestic low-skilled labor, though he later shifted to a more favorable view. But even if that is true, the question now is not whether immigration depresses wages. The real question facing the United States is, can the economy handle such a sudden shock to the labor market? A policy of halting the Biden-era open-border immigration policy is one thing, causing widespread damage to the economy by removing millions of laborers virtually overnight is another thing entirely. Immigration enforcement policies have theoretical benefits for specific labor markets, but the economic consequences of large-scale deportations, especially in states like California and Texas, may be overwhelmingly negative. The loss of labor, tax revenue, and economic demand, coupled with disruptions to local economies and service industries, suggests that such policies are economically detrimental on balance. Then, there is the human cost. This is not the first time the United States government has enforced a policy of mass deportations in response to illegal immigration. 70 years ago, the Eisenhower administration pursued a policy of mass deportation with the same missionary zeal that ICE is now engaged in under Tom Homan's direction as Trump's border czar. Launched in 1954, in a time where good old-fashioned racism was overt and on display for everyone to see without any sense of shame attached to it, the program was officially known as Operation Wetback. Intended to curb illegal immigration from Mexico, this operation marked a turning point in U.S. immigration policy, reflecting Cold War-era anxieties, nativist sentiments, and the increasing militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border. While publicly hailed by some politicians as a necessary response to labor concerns and national security, the program sparked substantial controversy due to its aggressive tactics and the deportation of American citizens of Mexican descent. The policy arose from a confluence of political, economic, and social pressures. Following World War II, labor shortages in the United States, particularly in agriculture, prompted the creation of the Bracero Program in 1942, a bilateral agreement that allowed Mexican laborers to work temporarily in the U.S. However, illegal immigration increased alongside legal migration, leading to fears of a, quote, wetback invasion, unquote, a term laced with derogatory connotations and used widely in political rhetoric. Arkansas Democrat Senator William Fulbright and other Southern Democrats were vocal in portraying undocumented Mexican laborers as a threat to American jobs and national identity. Meanwhile, conservative factions within the Eisenhower administration, notably Attorney General Herbert Brownell Jr., advocated for strict enforcement of immigration laws. President Eisenhower, concerned about border control and under pressure from constituents and agricultural lobbies demanding stable labor supply, authorized the INS, the precursor to today's ICE, to act decisively. The operation was spearheaded by INS Commissioner Joseph Swing, a former military general, who utilized quasi-military strategies. With support from state and local law enforcement, the INS launched raids across border states, particularly targeting California, Arizona, and Texas. The use of military-style tactics, roadblocks, sweeps of agricultural fields, and transportation of detainees in buses and ships, drew national attention, just as those same tactics are fueling protests today. Estimates suggest that over 1 million people were apprehended and deported during the operation, though exact numbers remain contested. The INS frequently deported individuals without proper hearings or verification of citizenship, and many were sent to unfamiliar regions deep in Mexico. Support for the program came primarily from conservative politicians and agricultural interests seeking to preserve the Bracero program by demonstrating enforcement of immigration laws. Democrat Senator Price Daniel of Texas and Democrat Representative Francis Walter of Pennsylvania, co-author of the McCarran-Walter Act of 1952, were vocal proponents. As expected, the program received pushbacks. Opposition emerged from civil rights organizations, labor unions, and some liberal politicians. Democrat Congressman Edward Roybal of California, one of the first Mexican-American members of Congress, decried the operation's racial profiling and violations of civil liberties. The American Civil Liberties Union and the League of United Latin American Citizens, or LULAC, documented abuses and filed protests, although these had limited immediate effect. Southern California and Texas bore the brunt of the operation. In Los Angeles, Large-scale raids disrupted communities, instilled fear among Mexican-American citizens, and led to the closure of some businesses due to labor shortages. In Texas, especially in border towns like El Paso and Brownsville, families were separated, and local economies suffered from the abrupt removal of labor. The economic consequences of the program were significant, particularly for industries reliant on Mexican labor. Agricultural sectors in California and Texas experienced labor shortages following the mass deportations, despite assurances from federal officials that deportations would not impact legal labor flows. Small businesses that employed or served Mexican and Mexican-American communities also saw declines in productivity and consumer activity. In Los Angeles and parts of the Central Valley, farms were left with rotting crops due to insufficient labor, prompting some growers to criticize the operation publicly. Moreover, the uncertainty caused by the raids deterred many remaining workers from showing up for jobs, further exacerbating shortages. Labor unions, such as the United Farm Workers, later pointed to the operation as an example of how deportation policies could disrupt entire regional economies. While the Bracero program, which I'll discuss in a minute, continued in parallel, it could not compensate immediately for the sudden drop in undocumented laborers, and the resulting instability weakened confidence in both federal enforcement and labor policy. Perhaps the most egregious outcome was the deportation of thousands of U.S. citizens of Mexican descent. Lax procedures and racial profiling meant that citizenship status was often ignored. A 1954 report indicated that as many as 60,000 American citizens may have been wrongfully deported. This sparked outrage in Mexican-American communities and became a catalyst for future civil rights activism. The program stands as a controversial chapter in U.S. immigration history. While it temporarily curtailed illegal immigration and appeased conservative demands for enforcement, it also violated civil liberties and disrupted countless lives. The program's legacy continues to inform debates about immigration enforcement, racial profiling, and the treatment of ethnic minorities in the United States. But, sadly, it also appears to be something the country must go through once more. Thus, it is a certainty that to soften the economic blow created by the mass deportation of millions of workers, someone in the Trump administration will propose a legal way to flood depressed sectors of the economy with an influx of needed workers. And like the renewal of the 1954 deportations we are seeing again today, a government-run guest worker program is also something that has been done before, only the idea for a new program has been kicked around for decades now, beginning with the administration of George W. Bush at the beginning of this century. In a dual press conference on September 6, 2001, which included Mexican President Vicente Fox, President George W. Bush stated his belief in a guest worker program as a way to stabilize immigration. Responding to a question on undocumented migration, Bush said, "If somebody is willing to do jobs others in America aren't willing to do, we ought to welcome that person to the country, and we ought to make that a legal part of our economy. We ought not to penalize an employer who's trying to get a job done, who hires somebody who's willing to do that kind of work." Immediately, this was derided in conservative circles and mocked by critics of migrant labor as they focused on the phrase, "jobs that Americans won't do." Of course, 5 days later, terrorists flew planes into the World Trade Center in New York and the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., and Bush's movement towards a guest worker program was suddenly on the back burner. Nevertheless, Bush did continue to push for a program, and in his 2007 State of the Union address, urged Congress to pass legislation creating one. The example that Bush and members of his administration used for a new guest worker initiative was the Bracero program. Initiated in 1942, it was a bilateral labor agreement between the United States and Mexico aimed at addressing wartime agricultural labor shortages. Over its 22-year duration, the program brought more than 4.5 million Mexican laborers into the United States. Though originally conceived as a temporary wartime measure, the program outlasted World War II by nearly two decades. The Mexican Farm Labor Agreement, signed on August 4, 1942, formally launched the program. Initiated during World War II, it was designed to address critical labor shortages in the agricultural sector caused by the conscription of American men and the expansion of war-related industries. The agreement promised Mexican workers fair wages, adequate housing, food, medical care, and protection from discrimination. In reality, oversight was inadequate, and many of these promises went unfulfilled. Under Public Law 78, passed in 1951, the program was institutionalized and continued through annual renewals. The federal government took over as guarantor of contracts, reinforcing the perception of a legitimate, humane guest worker system. However, administrative negligence, weak enforcement mechanisms, and collusion between growers and government agencies allowed systematic exploitation. The Bracero program depressed wages and undercut domestic labor organizing. In Oxnard, California, growers manipulated labor markets by fabricating shortages to justify importing braceros. The Farm Placement Service enabled these schemes by turning away local workers to ensure continued access to bracero labor. This artificial suppression of local employment created deep resentment among Mexican Americans and other domestic workers. In 1958, Cesar Chavez and members of the Community Service Organization mobilized protests against exploitation. Chavez focused attention on how the program undermined the economic standing of Mexican American workers and made early arguments for farm worker unionization. These local efforts foreshadowed the broader national struggle led by the United Farm Workers in the 1960s. Not unexpectedly, the Bracero program enjoyed strong support from American agribusinesses, particularly in California and Texas. Organizations such as the Western Growers Association and the American Farm Bureau lobbied Congress to maintain access to cheap, controllable labor. On the Mexican side, the government viewed the program as a means to alleviate unemployment and stimulate remittance flows. Despite widespread reports of abuse, both governments found it expedient to continue the program. Political backing in the U.S. Congress came primarily from representatives of agricultural districts who argued that American crops would rot in the fields without Mexican labor. As mechanization was slow to replace hand-picking in crops like cotton and lettuce, the economic argument remained persuasive throughout the 1950s. But while the program provided corporate agriculture with cheap labor, there were problems. Despite promises of humane treatment, braceros frequently endured squalid living conditions, inadequate food, wage theft, and dangerous working environments. Housing was often makeshift and overcrowded, while healthcare provisions were minimal. Exposure to pesticides and long workdays of up to 16 hours were common. A tragic event occurred in 1963 in Chualar, California, when 32 braceros died after their bus collided with a train. The event exposed the hazardous transportation conditions braceros faced and galvanized public opposition to the program. This incident, among others, revealed systemic disregard for worker safety, and it was not long before the program was finally ended. Ernesto Galarza's landmark Exposé Merchants of Labor in 1964 documented the failures and abuses of the program. Galarza, a labor organizer and scholar, meticulously chronicled how government agencies and growers colluded to maintain a system that denied basic rights to workers. Labor unions, including the AFL-CIO, became increasingly vocal in opposing the program, arguing that it suppressed wages and hindered domestic unionization. The activism of Chavez and others pushed local governments to end participation in the program. Public Law 78, passed in 1951, expired on December 31, 1964. Its termination resulted from a confluence of factors: mechanization reduced dependency on manual labor, labor unions intensified their opposition, and public scandals like the Chualar disaster exposed the program's human costs. Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta capitalized on this moment, founding the UFW and pressing for improved conditions for all farm workers, including former braceros. Despite its termination, the bracero program's legacy lingers. In the 2000s, former braceros and their descendants filed lawsuits seeking repayment of wages withheld in savings accounts. Although some restitution was eventually made, many workers never recovered what was owed. The Bracero program exemplified the contradictions of labor migration policy. It was both a solution to economic needs and a system of systemic exploitation. As the U.S. continues to grapple with immigration reform, the Bracero legacy offers a cautionary tale about the costs of prioritizing economic efficiency over human dignity. Mark Twain is thought to have once remarked, "History doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes." With that in mind, when the government once again decides to sanction the importation of cheap labor for American business, we must demand transparency and accountability to prevent the abuses of the Bracero program from becoming part of the process. To be perfectly blunt, the idea of a whiter American Southwest, predominantly English-speaking, that resembles the days of the 1950s are over. That ship sailed a long time ago. Today, the demographics of the Southwest are on the move towards an inevitable future that is more Hispanic and less Anglo, and no amount of ICE enforcement is going to slow that momentum. Those who support the policy of massive deportation and believe the only consequence will be higher-paying jobs for U.S. citizens are deluding themselves. Just as was the case, there is a terrible human cost. Families will be torn apart, and the pushback will only grow as the negative consequences become more and more visible. There will be an economic cost as well, something that will also cause political upheaval for many years to come. The better path, and the only rational path, is to control immigration at the border and absorb those who are already here in an orderly fashion. Call that amnesty if you must, and there can be a rational debate about whether those here now can ever have a path to citizenship, as compared to legal resident status only. But it is clear, and it will become even more apparent as the status quo moves ahead, that mass deportations are going to have the kind of unintended consequences nobody desires. That concludes this week's episode. If you find this podcast informative or entertaining, please like and subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen. The same goes if you tune in on YouTube. Also, if you have anything you would like to add to the conversation, please leave a comment. There is a 100% chance I will see your comment. Being a semi-retired, currently unemployed podcaster does have its advantages after all. Until next week, remember to stay informed and fight to keep your political representatives accountable. Your freedom depends on it.